This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, more questions about the White House staff emails that have mysteriously disappeared, plus new efforts to get people to pay attention to Darfur, Sudan. Joining us today to talk about these stories and more, we've got Callie Crossley, commentator on the Boston television show Beat the Press, Robert George, editorial writer at the New York Post and a former senior writer for House Speaker Newt Gingrich from 1995 to 1998, and Marcelo Suarez Orozco, professor of globalization and education and co-director immigration studies at New York University. So welcome, everybody, and let's go to the missing emails. The White House has announced that it may have lost thousands of emails that Congress is seeking for its investigation into the firing of eight U.S. attorneys. Dozens of White House officials appear to have used political email accounts run by the Republican National Committee to administer official government business. Now, at least 4 years' worth of emails belonging to the White House senior advisor Karl Rove are missing. The RNC and White House both promise they're doing all they can to retrieve the data, but critics say this is a serious legal breach, and techies say, huh? So, Robert, as someone who, I'm an email addict, and you know what? Email is becoming more like cellulite. You can't get rid of it even if you try. So, yeah, so what's going on here?
Well, in the wonderful words of Ricky Ricardo, the White House has a lot of explaining to do. Look, first of all, as many people will realize that, you know, you even when you delete emails from your computer, when you delete certain files that you might not want your significant other to stumble upon, unless you are know exactly what you're doing and have like a really good eraser, and they're there, the imprints are there. So for them to say that they have lost them, quote unquote, kind of defies belief. And apparently, it actually may even be much more than thousands, because there's this watchdog group, Crew, who actually became a little bit well known in the Mark Foley scandal last year. They say it actually could be as many as millions of emails from a number of different accounts and so forth that have gone missing. And I mean, if you just take a look at the blogosphere, there are a number of conservative-leaning bloggers that are just kind of rolling their eyes, saying there's something weird going on here. Let's just put it that way.
Callie, let's talk a little bit about the separation of church and state that's supposed to exist between the political parties and people from those political parties who were in office. So this was government business being done with a political party email. Explain a little bit more about that.
Yes, that's the thing that people have to understand, that there were, in effect, two sets of books, if you will, from an email perspective. There were the official government email accounts issued to people who work in the White House and have official responsibilities for the White House. And then there were some people who bled over into the work of the Republican National Committee. And for those people, they were issued a separate set of email accounts and, you know, all communication tools, because political organizing is not supposed to be taking place on government time or with government equipment. So it becomes critically important when you think about somebody like a Karl Rove, who actually has a role in as President Bush's closest advisor, but he's also obviously a driver for the Republican National Committee. And, you know, according to the reports, he did 95% of his emails on the Republican National Committee site. So that would mean that all of his government business, those emails are over there. And that violates the Presidential Records Act. So it's more than just this one incident involving the firing of these U.S. attorneys. It's really about a broader issue about preservation of important records for historians and for those in the future to be able to look back and see how business was conducted. So this is very serious business.
Marcelo, do you think that this is going to have traction? I mean, you know, America's a big country. We have a lot of things on our plate, everything from, you know, kind of the Don Imus type controversies to issues about the war, you know, how much money the government is spending. Celebrities are on most people's mind. Is this something that's going to really get any traction in America's consciousness?
Well, as Robert said, this will all depend, of course, on whether these emails have, in fact, been permanently erased. The devil dwells in the details. So if we begin to recover some of these emails, and if we begin to get a sense of the range of issues, as Callie said, we're talking about perhaps as many as 5 million emails now, which could really mean a kind of a massive outsourcing of official government functions to these privatized accounts. So the traction will be a function of will we rescue some of these official government documents. Remember here, there are security issues. There are historical issues, as Callie said. There's a whole range of issues, and we really don't yet have a sense of the magnitude and of the quality of the documents that may be in circulating in this never-never land of erased emails.
And there,
that
and there,
thing exists.
And there are two things to keep in mind here. One, the whole issue of the U.S. attorney's firing is going to be front and center for the next couple of days because Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez is going to be testifying on Capitol Hill tomorrow. So that's going to be concentrating a lot of people's minds. And then there's also this issue of executive privilege because the White House seems to be making the assertion that not only are emails that are on official White House in the official White House system, not only do those are those considered executive privilege, but Fred Fielding, the White House counsel, is making the argument that the missing emails that if they turn up that are on the RNC's server, they may have privilege attached to them as well, which could really spark a constitutional crisis that could end up at the Supreme Court.
Well, let me move on to another topic. But before I do, let's revisit and reintroduce everybody. Robert, just checking in with you. Robert George, an editorial writer at The New York Post. We've also got Callie Crossley, commentator on the Boston television show Beat the Press, and Marcelo Suarez Orozco, professor of globalization and education at New York University. And this is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. I want to turn to Darfur, Sudan. It was a week full of news on Darfur, and one of the most interesting pieces was that Google Earth, which is, of course, a satellite mapping system that you can access through the Google.com website, Google Earth has a whole section devoted to Sudan where you can see the effect of the atrocities or the alleged atrocities. It allows people to download free software and really scan over where people have been killed and displaced. They have icons for destroyed villages and refugee camps. It's really an interesting intersection of technology and activism. At the same time, there's a pressure from Hollywood folks to really get the Chinese government to divest from Sudan. And Sudan is a country with oil, and the Chinese government has been quite friendly with it. So how do we take these different efforts, Callie, that, you know, you've got the technology angle, you've got the celebrity angle, you have individual divestment in certain cases from universities. Is this all going to continue to build pressure to have a intervention and resolution, or are all these efforts too scattered?
No, actually, I think this very much reminds me of the anti-apartheid movement against South Africa and what it really takes when you're doing something. We have a global issue that seems so devastating and so overwhelming and so centered only in what governments do. People who are active around these issues are looking for points of entry. And when you can find points of entry that actually have some meaningful impact, they're not actually small. It builds and builds and builds, and then you finally get a bonfire. They're like these, you know, really ripe kindling going on to the fire. So I have to say that the Google thing is exciting because people can see. You know, yes, there are stories about it, but there's never enough stories about it. As you know, several people have been out front trying to keep attention on what's happening there and using the tools of their trade, Ann Curry and Nicholas Kristof, among them. But something about sitting in your own little desk and clicking on a tent and looking at it may impact some people in ways that they have not been affected before, in ways that those other broader stories have not. With regard to the China divestiture, I mean, that's a fabulous thing because now we have Hollywood celebrities saying, okay, we've been standing up talking about it. Now, what is the way that I can make this go a little further? So by honing in on China's involvement in the Beijing Olympics and saying, we don't want to support, and we're going to ask other people of goodwill not to support a country doing the Olympics if they, in fact, are going to support this kind of genocide. We're just not going to have it. All of these things, and then the divestiture on university campuses and people's own personal stock portfolios, that's exactly what happened with the anti-apartheid movement, and as you know, that was quite successful. Long term, but it worked.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, we can't – I mean, one of the interesting things about what's going on, particularly with Google versus, say, the anti-apartheid movement, you know, South Africa was and is a huge country, and so that kind of concentrated the people's mind. Sudan is a relatively small country, and we can no longer use the old excuse of, well, you know, Americans can't even find it on a map, because, you know, well, hello, Google has just helped you out with that. So now you know exactly where it is. You can point to specific areas where people are actually dying. So that really does literally bring it home. And to echo what Callie said, this is one of the rare times where I think that China will be really, really sensitive to public pressure, to global pressure, because I was over in China last summer, and it is very, very clear that they are going out of their way to put on their best face for the world coming in for the Olympics next year. So they are going to be more susceptible to being nudged on some of these issues than they otherwise would have been.
Marcelo, it's not a nudge so much as a shove when people start protesting the genocide games, which is one of the activist nicknames for the 2008 Olympics. At the same time, the Chinese government has been pushing Sudan now to accept the UN peacekeeping force. There's obviously some self-interest involved. You know, people want to make sure that their Olympics go off without a hitch. But at the same time, how important is China's involvement in changing whatever can go on in the Sudan?
Well, China is now has a very big footprint in Africa. I was recently in Beijing, and right at the time where the Afro-Chinese summit was taking place with most of the senior heads of state from the leading African nations participating. And China, of course, plays the key role because we need to remember that the Sudan sells a lot of its oil to the Chinese. So China, increasingly geopolitically and economically, as it enters the global stage, there is the quid pro quo here of doing business, increasing political clout, and increasing accountability and responsibility. So China may be the key player here, and as Robert suggested, there is really a quid pro quo. The Olympics are a big deal because it really will showcase the new globalized, the new modern China, the China that has entered with full force into global capitalism. And you can't have it both ways. You can't be protecting a genocidal regime really in a kind of a business transaction for oil and ripping the benefits of being a big player in the world of major democracies. So how this will play moving forward, I think it's a very interesting development because it will, A, showcase China as an important player in African politics and in the African dynamic now, and it also shows how the whole world is watching. This is really the first time where we have real-time feedback on an ongoing genocidal campaign. Everybody's watching. You can watch it. That changes everything. This is very, very different from what we've seen before, where it takes time to gather the data, where it takes time to get the information out. Everybody's watching now.
It's a combination of activism, technology, and other forces coming together. And economic interest, yeah. Thank you.
Actorvism, in a sense.
Actorvism, yeah, with the celebrities. Very good.
A lot of celebrities in there. All right, maybe I should have saved it for tomorrow, but I'm just going to go for it. Speed round. Rudy Giuliani, presidential candidate, says earlier this month that he thinks about the decision to fly the Confederate battle flag should be made on a state-by-state basis. He doesn't want to come out against the flag. You remember there was a big flap when Howard Dean went and sort of waffled around the Confederate flag issue. Speed round. Almost no time. Start with you, Robert. Is this something that he's doing to pander to southern states, or is this a political necessity, or both?
It's both. I think there's a very easy answer for a Republican to say this, even though it may not get him votes down in the South. But it's very simple to say the Confederate flag was the battle flag, was the flag that was going against the Union. We are the United States, the Union won, and the flag of a foreign power should not be flying over any state capital.
Marcelo?
It's a litmus test, and he knows exactly what he's doing to gather the Southern Republican folk behind him.
Callie?
I agree. Somebody needs to hire Robert to get that line and use it, because they're clearly not using that, and it needs to be. If they're not saying that, then it's all about pandering.
All right. Well, that's it for today. We've been talking to Callie Crossley, commentator on the Boston television show Beat the Press from the studios of Harvard University, Robert George, editorial writer at the New York Post and a former senior writer for House Speaker Newt Gingrich from 95 to 98 from NPR New York, and Marcelo Suarez Orozco, professor of globalization and education. Thanks, folks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And, as always, if you'd like to comment on any of the topics you've heard on the roundtable, call us at 202-408-3330. That's 202-408-3330. Or you can send us an email. Just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. Be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.